Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If you know what you're doing, you can create all kinds of havoc using the internet, right? WikiLeaks, anybody? Governments and companies are trying to shut the website down. Supporters are trying to make them pay a price. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday today, the 8th of December. Good as always to have you here. You don't actually need to visit MasterCard.com or Visa.com to use your credit cards, but that is kind of beside the point, I suppose. Both sites were knocked offline by hackers today, apparently in retaliation for MasterCard, PayPal, Amazon, and some others having decided to stop processing donations to the WikiLeaks website. Not only did the hackers disable MasterCard.com, they changed the company's Wikipedia entry as well so that it read, MasterCard is an evil puppet of the U.S. government, and some other things I can't really say on a family radio show. MasterCard is back up and running. The Wikipedia entry is back to normal. But the attack and this whole concept of hacktivism, as it's being called, does have huge implications for business. From New York Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The attack against MasterCard was launched by a group of hackers known as Anonymous.
It's becoming more and more like something that resembles the movie Fight Club. And these guys are pretty riled up.
Barrett Lyon knows Anonymous well. He used to run a business that helped companies defend against cyber attacks. He says it's a loose-knit global network that enlists people to download software, which allows them to load a company's website over and over until it crashes.
What these guys have done is said, hey, join our cause. Put our software on your computer willingly and kick back and enjoy the show.
Lyon says attacks like today's aren't that hard to mount, but they are expensive to prevent. He says subscribing to a good security system costs upwards of $10,000 a month. Ted Julian analyzes online security for the Yankee Group.
The economics here just stink, right? Because for the bad guys, these resources are free, whereas the good guys are using resources they've paid for. So it's a real crappy arms race.
Many big companies are already well protected, says Greg Hausch, who used to be affiliated with the hacker group Anonymous. Hausch points out Amazon and PayPal's websites withstood attack today. And he says a lot of people have to come together to take down a company's website.
All of these types of events really require numbers. You know, it doesn't require one single person being amazing at what he does. It requires thousands of people doing little things together in concerted effort.
Hausch estimated between 1,000 and 3,000 people took part in the MasterCard attack, and he predicts we'll see more of them because, for one thing, they can work. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
So here's a thought. What if, instead of calling it a tax cut deal, we call the agreement between congressional leaders and the White House the other day a stimulus plan, a way to get the economy going again? Economists are already crunching the numbers, and the consensus does seem to be that if it's eventually passed, the thing won't be bad for the economy, at least in the short run. The question is how much good it can really do. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports now from Washington.
The tax deal has economists raising their forecasts for economic growth. Economists at Moody's Analytics are bullish. They've raised their growth projections for next year from 2.8% to 4%. Moody's economist Gus Fauché says the tax plan is a kind of stealth stimulus package.
It's putting more money in consumers' hands through tax cuts and expanded unemployment insurance benefits. So it really is a stimulus package, even if nobody wants to say that.
Fauché says the tax deal extends jobless benefits and cuts Social Security taxes. People living paycheck to paycheck will have more money to spend, and they tend to spend all they have. Stuart Hoffman is chief economist at PNC Financial Services Group. He's not so bullish because the tax package is mainly an extension of existing tax rates.
It's not that stimulative to just maintain things as they were.
There's another reason the tax deal might not be a huge stimulus, according to Howard Gleckman of the Tax Policy Center. He says the biggest tax cuts go to the rich, who don't go right out and spend the money.
There's only so much that you can spend. People at the very high ends generally don't change their consumption based on a tax cut.
The very rich might put the extra cash in the stock market or buy a new house. Moody's economist Fauché says those are investments with no immediate benefits. He's counting on the rest of us to snap up new cars or appliances. I'm thinking about a new toaster. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Not a whole lot of motion on Wall Street today. All three major indices closed within sight of where they started. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This isn't a fun number to remind people of this time of year, but the reality is that more than 15 million people are out of work in this country right now. As the layoffs piled up the past 3 years, they hit almost everybody, a pretty broad sweep of the American economy. There's a film opening in New York and Los Angeles this Friday, just in time for Oscar nominations, about a slice of those layoffs, people who don't have much experience with losing their jobs, white, male, white-collar workers. The film is called The Company Men. It stars Ben Affleck as one of three well-paid white-collar guys cut loose by the struggling shipping company they work for and not handling it real well.
What the hell's going on? I just got thrown off the course of the club.
Hey, keep your voice down.
We haven't paid the dues since October?
Yeah, I've paid a lot of things.
I look like a f***ing deadbeat.
This is real, Bobby. Okay, this is happening to us. You are wandering around like you're in some sort of a daze, but you're playing golf? You getting your Porsche detailed?
Today in our series, The Art of Money, what artists and others see when they look at the economy, John Wells. He wrote, produced, and directed The Company Men. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
A lot of the stories in this film are middle, upper middle class Americans. That clearly was an important point for you.
Well, yeah, one of the things I discovered, I really assumed when I started that it was going to be a lot of the blue-collar workers. And the blue-collar workers were angry, upset about what had happened to them. But they weren't crushed in the same way or lost in the same way that the white-collar workers were. And it was a very interesting thing, and it took me a little while to kind of figure it out. But what seemed to be the common theme is that when you're working in white-collar, particularly when you're working in finance and things, in areas in which you have no physical representation of what you actually do day-to-day, that the only thing that you can show people that you're actually working is the things that you own, the things that you possess, your clothing, your car, your home. And so what started to happen was I realized that they were the people who ended up being the most lost because they were the ones who had no idea what they'd actually done and really started to question the value of what they did.
And that's really the Ben Affleck character in this film, this guy who drives a really nice car, has a really nice house, and almost literally is lost the day he gets laid off.
Yeah, really doesn't know what the next thing is. You sort of assume there's an arrogance to it. You don't necessarily like this character as the film begins.
You don't like him at all, for a while in this film, anyway.
And you come to feel, I believe, a lot of sympathy for him because you realize that this is actually something that we all go through.
This has been called, actually, as long as we're talking about that Ben Affleck character, I mean, this has been called the man session because it hit white-collar males so hard.
And it's not over, unfortunately. I mean, when we started making the film in 2008, I think we all assumed that we'd be releasing it as a historical document. But by the time the film came out, that it would actually be something that happened. And now we're going through sort of waves of it. American men are having to reassess what their relationship is to their work, what their relationship is to what they value in their work and with their families. And there's an uplifting or an attempt at an uplifting message in the film that we will come out of this. We do come out of these things as a country, but not without a lot of sacrifice and a lot of personal difficulty.
His character, Bobby, goes through outplacement services, as so many millions of Americans have. And there's a scene in a seminar room, I guess it is, where this, you know, training leader says to him, you know, the mantra is,
I will win. Why? I will show you why, because I have faith, courage, enthusiasm. Everybody this time. I will win.
I mean, you can see Ben Affleck and me in the audience and millions of people just going, oh, come on, man. What was going through your mind as you wrote that film?
Well, you know, I actually didn't write that. I sort of transcribed it. I went and visited some outplacement centers, and that is actually everything that's said in that scene was said by a woman who ran a group here in Los Angeles doing the Tiger. And I asked her about it afterward. I said, don't you feel slightly ridiculous doing that? And she said, people come in here virtually suicidal. They're comatose. They're in shock. They've been in a major automobile accident. And we're responsible for getting up and moving. And I look at myself as the same thing a physical therapist does after surgery, is I'm going to be upbeat, and I'm going to grab them, I'm going to pull them out of that bed, and I'm going to make them walk down the hall.
Did you ever, as you were plotting out how to get this movie made, think about, instead of doing a major studio, big budget, expensive stars movie, do a small indie thing?
This is a small indie thing. It's just a small indie thing that a whole bunch of actors, I was really, really lucky to get them to do it. No, the movie was made for very little money and on a very short schedule. And I thought I was going to have to get the actors involved with people who were actually going through this so that they could talk to them and kind of get some of the experience. I didn't have to. Everybody had a family member or a very close friend who was going through it. You know, Chris Cooper and Kevin Costner both have very close family members who are going through it. Everybody knew somebody or a lot of somebodies.
John Wells and his new film, The Company Men. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Economists from Ben Bernanke on down are talking more about deflation than inflation. There's been no inflation in the U.S. economy for a long while now. Still, some investors are worried about rising prices, not falling, and their trades show it. First, they bid up the price of gold the past couple of years. Now, silver is following. Silver is up almost 70% since August. Commentator David Frum wonders how come.
Geologists tell us that silver is about 17 or 18 times more plentiful in the Earth's crust than gold. Historically, the silver-to-gold price has fluctuated around 16 to 1, 16 ounces of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold. So when the price of gold surged to 66 times the price of silver this past summer, that should have sounded a warning that something was amiss. Some might have interpreted this huge differential in the prices of the two metals as a warning that gold was joining tulip bulbs and pets.com in the annals of financial bubbles. But more seem to have decided, no, gold wasn't too high. Silver was too low. Since August, the price of silver has surged. Last week, the federal government reported more disappointing job news. The yield on 10-year U.S. bonds hovers about 3%, an indication that bond investors foresee zero inflation. You'd think that this bad general economic news would also be bearish news for metals. Instead, bad news for gold is reinterpreted as good news for silver. This reminds me of the late phases of the housing boom, when buyers persuaded themselves that if they could not afford a $2 million house on the west side of Los Angeles, that a $500,000 house in the Antelope Valley must be a tremendous bargain. Well, perhaps they're all right. Anyway, who cares? Metal buyers are consenting adults. Let them buy what they want. But more than almost any other commodity, gold buyers are small investors, not always very sophisticated, and relentlessly huckstered by advertisers and talk radio personalities. They pay premiums averaging $100 an ounce to buy gold in the most expensive way, as coin rather than as bars. From the outside, this market looks a lot more like a mania than like a prudent hedge against inflation risk. Warren Buffett once marveled at the market for gold. We dig it out of the ground, shape it into bars, then bury it again. Why? Silver is not quite so crazy. You can at least fashion it into lovely candlesticks, if you don't buy it at the top of the market.
David Frum is the editor of Frum Forum. Once upon a time, he was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Next week, in his regular spot, the musings of Robert Reich. Your comments are welcome anytime. Marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, selling the trademarks of times gone by.
These brands not only generate nostalgia, they have clear value because the consumer remembers them.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 13 points today, about a tenth of 1%, ended at 11,372, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ rose 10 points, 0.4%, closed at 2609. The S&P 500 climbed 4 points, a 0.3%, finished at 1228. Morgan Stanley charged up more than 3% today after an investment group got permission to buy its big stake in China International Capital. Bank of America put on 3.7%. Good to be a headhunter these days, boy. I'll tell you, Korn Ferry International roped in more than 16%. The executive search firm reported earnings that beat expectations. AIG stepped down 3.7% today and reports that the government is looking to unload at least $15 billion worth of shares in the insurance company early next year. 10-year T-note fell again. The yield rose to 3.25%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. By Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at microsoft.com/cloud. And by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee discusses the state of the credit union industry. The United Nations marks International Anti-Corruption Day, calling on business leaders worldwide to denounce corruption. And yesterday I mentioned that the Commerce Department was going to release its monthly wholesale trade report today. That report, covering October, comes out tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to pick up our philanthropy series today with an interesting idea, letting it all hang out, organizationally speaking, radical transparency. The nonprofit group Water for People works to provide safe drinking water and sanitation all over the world. And a couple of years ago, they put in a new system to track their project, how things are working out in real time, right there for everybody to see on the web. Ned Breslin is the CEO of Water for People. Ned, good to have you with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Describe this transparency system you put in place, would you?
We developed a system called FLOW. It stands for Field Level Operation Watch. And you go in the field, GPS a water point, take a picture of it, or you could take a video. You answer a series of questions on whether water's flowing, whether the quantity of water is sufficient for the people who are using it, whether the quality meets certain standards. And what it does is it takes that information, it loads it up onto Google Earth or Google Maps, and you basically can see the results of water and sanitation interventions around the world.
Or, just to be clear here, whether they were flops. I mean, this tracks failures as much as it does success.
Yeah, and I think that's the real power of it, is that the water sector in general and the development sector often tells you that we've taken your money and we've done a good thing and everything is fine. But if you go overseas, you see a lot of broken water points. You see a lot of wasted investments. And this will highlight it and bring to light both successes and failures so that we can address failures. And I think the donor world and the philanthropic world is quite interested in more openness and more transparency.
Let me ask you a question, though, about those donors. I mean, if they can see that some of these projects you're working on aren't working, do you worry about them not funding you because of this transparency?
I actually am finding the opposite. I think that the nonprofit world generally makes statements like donors don't want to know or we can't tell donors because we'll lose funding. I think when you have a dialogue with them that basically says, look, this is what we're trying to do, you get to a different level of discussion with them. And what we often find is that the things that we don't do well, donors can often come in and say, have you thought about this or have you linked with this particular organization or how can we help you improve on that? So we get better quality results through more honesty and transparency than we do by just telling a good story and letting people think that, you know, everything's fine.
When you first brought this idea to your staff, did everybody jump up and say, oh, man, Ned, awesome idea? I mean, was it universally adopted?
No. Not at all. I think it's a real challenge for some people. And Water for People has gone through a bit of a staff transformation over time. So we've had some staff leave, quite honestly. And we've brought in, I think, a very rich and dynamic group of people who actually embrace and are quite inspired by this. And frankly, we're a much more interesting organization as a result. But yes, there was pushback.
It's not just donors, though, who can see this, right? Water for People is not the only water agency out there. Is there a competitiveness aspect to this? Because you are competing, I would suppose, for the same donor and grant and foundation dollars with other groups.
I see Flow as a way for the sector to coordinate better, and that if all organizations are putting information online and showing the results of their work over time, then it actually empowers nonprofits to start working together, and that's really what we need.
Ned Breslin is the CEO of the nonprofit group Water for People. Ned, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This being a Wednesday, we'd usually do our letters segment right about here, but since we've been talking philanthropy this week, we wanted to know how your charitable giving has changed over the past year.
Roger Cook. I'm a retired college professor. I live in Burlington, Vermont. We're comfortably off, so, you know, we feel that if anybody can make up the slack, it's us retired people, and we have to do it.
My name is Martha Reifschneider. I live in Silver Spring, Maryland, and I'm a volunteer docent with the National Park Service at the National Mall. Instead of giving to our alma mater universities, we've basically shifted all of that giving to things like food banks and other organizations that directly help people, especially who are affected by the recession.
My name is Andrew DePalma. I live in upstate New York near Albany. Right now I'm a postal worker, and I'm also a retired military officer. I just started getting my Army retirement check, so we have a little more money to spare, so we can afford to, you know, give some good charities our money.
My name is Patty Stolzoff. I live in Seattle. And I'm a dental hygienist. I have doubled the amount that I give to food banks because there's more hungry people. I know from experience that giving cash, they can make a dollar go farther than they can if you give them a can of beans.
I know that a lot of the giving to those organizations drops when the economy turns bad because many people just don't have those kind of discretionary dollars.
I write one check a year myself to United Way and tell them to divide it between the Visiting Nurse Association and Retired Senior Volunteers Program.
The need is always great, and it's just something that is an important part of what we do when we sit down and write checks every month.
I think everybody should do what they can, you know, whether it's, you know, a little kid giving their pennies that they saved or, you know, a big person having a few extra dollars to give to, in my case, a local charity.
You can hear all the stories in our philanthropy series online and offer up your stories as well online. Our homepage is marketplace.org. There was an auction of sorts at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City today. Here's just a brief list of some of the items up for sale. Bobby Socks, Collier's Magazine, Lucky Whip Topping, Meister Brau Beer as well. Not the actual products, mind you. They haven't been around for decades now. But the names, those might be worth something. A company called Brands USA Holdings is selling off the trademarks that it owns. Marketplace Jennifer Collins explores the prospect of putting a dollar amount on one of those names.
Sasha Strauss has been in the branding business for 16 years. He didn't remember half of the 170 trademarks on the block.
So I called my grandmother and my mother and father today.
And asked them to list the trademarks they remembered.
So I'm rattling off these names and they've got their pens and papers out.
Relaxicizer, Handy Wrap, Braniff Airlines. Maybe you remember Hot Pants?
My mother screams into the phone, "Oh my God, I wore those when I graduated from pharmacy school." And, you know, of course, I go to this, like, my mother is walking across the stage in, like, bikini shorts.
Embarrassing, yes. But Strauss says those OMG moments add value to a trademark. Take Handy Wrap, the plastic film behind countless memories of leftover tuna casserole and day-old meatloaf.
Oh, you ain't got a thing if you ain't got that cling. Do wrap, do wrap, do wrap.
Strauss thinks the Handy Wrap name and others like it could be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Michael Reich owns Brands USA Holdings, the company selling the trademarks. He says old brand names can be used to sell new products, anchor a website, or tap into the growing market for kitsch. You know, T-shirts and tchotchkes with vintage logos.
These brands not only generate nostalgia, but they have clear value because the consumer remembers them.
Unfortunately, that has very little to do with the brand's value.
Rob Frankel is a branding consultant. He says you can't bank on recognition alone.
People need to remember what the brand was for, why they felt that it was worth paying for, why they did pay for it, how it solved the problems in their life.
He says another way to look at an old brand's value is to consider what it would cost to launch a new one.
It's much, much easier to attach your product to an established, proven brand with a track record, and it's way less expensive than to try and go out and build one like that. Way less expensive.
Take electronics maker Packard Bell, no relation to Bell Labs or Hewlett Packard. The company was founded in the 20s, and one of its radios famously brought hope to a bunch of castaways. In the 80s, a few investors bought the Packard Bell name for less than $100,000. They put it on a line of home computers that became top sellers as PCs took off in the 90s.
Packard Bell. Wouldn't you rather be at home?
Strauss is hoping for many more Packard Bell-style revivals out of today's auction. He says the sale could be a stimulus package for his industry, from trademark lawyers to graphic designers.
Our hands are all clasped and rubbing, you know, like cannot wait for this to happen. It's going to be like a holiday gift.
And not just for the branding folks. If they do their jobs, you may be in line for a pair of hot pants, a workout gadget from Relaxicizer, maybe even a T-shirt with a Handy Wrap logo. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric. By Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms committed to helping business owners and in-house counsel find local, pre-qualified legal counsel for over 20 years. Meritas.org. And by Putnam Investments, helping investors save for retirement since 1937. For the latest retirement news, you can talk to your advisor, then visit RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, solace the next time you get stuck behind somebody paying by check at the grocery store. The Federal Reserve said today checks now account for less than a quarter of all transactions. Plastic, obviously, is the big gainer, but it's debit cards mostly, not credit cards. Just thought that was interesting. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday. Today, the Dow gained 13 points, about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ up 10 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 climbed 4 points, about a third of 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, philanthropy by way of competition.
When you become obsessed with the campaign, you literally are watching it around the clock. You wake up in the middle of the night and you check it.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.